Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2018. Lecture 3, delivered on January 24, 2018. The title of this lecture is Ethics.
Today, ethics. Now, I have a brief topic to cover still from the previous lecture, but to begin the conversation on ethics, I will inform you right now that this can get uncomfortable. This lecture will have its highs and its lows. You'll laugh and then you might be offended, but that's what college is for, is to rattle your cage sometimes. And we don't do nearly enough of that because we're afraid you'll be offended. Notice how I'm afraid. But before I get to the ethics lecture, I do want to cover one really important subject with you. It starts out with something that you think is kind of trivial, but it gets into something that is actually huge. It will be much more important in the years to come. But the first thing I want to do, now watch me really limp. Okay. Madam, what is money? Good. You're wrong, but that means that you are now going to be my victim, okay? We're cave people, okay? And you are a specialist in hunting moose. You go out, you hunt moose, you kill moose, you sell moose, you trade it. I, in my cave in the middle of nowhere in the Paleolithic era, I make pies, okay? So you come to me and you say, I have moose. And I say, I have pies. And so you say, okay, would you trade moose for pies? Because my pies are known all over the prehistoric world. I mean, and so got it from my grandmother. She was a Neanderthal. Okay. So they do have a little rough edge. They don't have the doily along the side. But, okay. So we decide, okay, four pies, and you'll give me a moose. They're good pies. And you and I, and we shake hands, and deal's done, okay? Well, you go out and you hunt another moose, and you go to this gentleman's cave. Now, he makes dried flower arrangements. There's nothing wrong with it. It's not a crime, man. Okay. And you take a moose to him. I have moose. And so he said, well, I have dried flower arrangements. So you two make a deal. 8 dried flower arrangements for 1 moose. Now, notice what has happened here is we have had an agreement. Your moose is the boss. Uh-huh. You can trade your moose with me for 4 pies, with him for 8 flower arrangements. So you have become the base of an exchange rate that we now know that there are 2 flower arrangements for each pie because you and your moose have seen to it. And so it goes. You can trade your moose a lot of places for different things you need. You know, car repairs. They were kind of like cars. They weren't cars. They were just, you jumped on a wild animal and you went as far as it went. Money is anything that is generally accepted in exchange. Money is anything that is generally accepted in exchange. In the modern world, we keep thinking that money is just this one thing, and I need you to go backward so that you can go forward. Now, there are, okay, make sure you know that. Money is anything that is readily accepted in exchange. Now, I want to bring up a term here that is actually quite important, and it will be all through this course, but this is the place where I can start that process. Liquidity. Liquidity is the efficiency, and that means the low cost and the cost of and the speed with which one asset can be exchanged for another asset. Liquidity is the efficiency with which one asset can be exchanged for another asset. So going back to you one more time, you go to pull through the drive-thru at Chick-fil-A. I should like 2 Chick-fil-A sandwiches, extra pickles. Now, you pull up to the counter and you have a choice. Do I offer them a mousse or do I offer them a $20 bill? Which one will be more likely to get you your sandwiches? The $20 bill. In other words, there is a ranking of liquidity here. Clearly, cash is much more highly liquid. You have a liquidity. You actually do. But you are very low liquidity. Because even though you will have extraordinary value, especially since you've had me as your professor, it will be a slow process over many years by which you will extract that value through your salary. As a professional, a house has low liquidity. Yes, you could sell a house for quite a bit of money, but it would take you a while to convert it to another asset, cash. Now, there's this myth, and this is one of those things where I ask on an exam, what is liquidity? And people have gone to the internet for their answer. Oh, liquidity is the ease with which an asset can be turned into cash. That's wrong. Cash is an asset. It's how quickly one asset can be turned into another asset. So you can't say it's how fast you can turn an asset into cash. Well, that cash has liquidity, so you're using kind of a circular definition. So understand, by the way, that quite a bit of our transactional basis is not in cash anyway. That's where we get to the next part. And I won't take too much of your time with this, but it comes to a very important point. What we did there, your mousse was barter money. Barter money. Barter money has 2 characteristics. All of these do in a different balance. Now, barter money has low liquidity. You're not sure someone's going to want a mousse. It turns out that mousse has a lot of gluten, and you're a gluten-free person, so you can't. Do mousse have gluten? I don't know. Maybe I should ask one. Bullwinkle. Do you even remember Bullwinkle? Hey, rookie, what should we pull a rabbit out of my... Anyway, stay on point. Okay, now, barter money has low liquidity, but it is entirely consumable as the asset. So I can trade mousse or I can eat mousse. I can use the whole thing. I can trade a pie or I can eat the pie completely. So barter money has low liquidity and high consumability. The next type of money that came along historically was what we call commodity or metal money. Commodity or metal money. Now, interestingly, commodity money will have a higher liquidity than barter money, but it will not be as consumable. Have you ever eaten a silver coin? Did you see that thing? You can buy these tablets that you eat and they have gold flecks in them. You swallow the tablet and then you digest it. Oh, that's nasty. I mean, it's expensive. Why would you do that? There was a restaurant I was told about. I didn't go there, but they said they sprinkle the gold on the food. And, oh, God, that's weird. Okay. However, you can use metal money as money, but you could also use it for other things. For example, gold can be used in circuits. We find many examples through history of arrowheads, metal arrowheads, and you can see the outline of the imprint of a coin from which it was hammered. So there's this middle ground. It's higher liquidity than barter money, but it is not as consumable. It's only partially consumable. And the last traditional kind of money is what is called fiat. Actually, it's called fiat, but I've gotten eaten alive by too many people who say, well, it's fiat. Well, no, not, it's fiat, but whatever. Okay, fiat money is this stuff right here. Ma'am, can you read me what it says right there?
This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private.
Legal. It is only money by decree of law. It has almost no intrinsic value, but it has extraordinarily high liquidity. You can actually use it. So it does have some, and there are situations where you might use money for some purpose other than to trade. It's made of a linen, all that. But it has very low consumability. But it has some, a tiny bit. That's important. The difference between absolutely none and a little tiny bit is huge here. So fiat money is just the nation or the sovereign, the king or whatever, has declared that you will use this, accept it in transactions. It is legal tender for all debts, public and private. Okay? So that means that probably people wouldn't use it as much, maybe, I don't know. Now notice something interesting here. This ascension does not mean one wiped out the one before it. They always coexist. And interestingly enough, in bad times, we tend to see the balance move backward. So in other words, in a recession, people would probably be, some people would gather gold coins, and other people would probably just go to working with each other for, oh, I need some car repairs, you got a garage, and I'll tell you what, I'll make you some food for it, and all that kind of stuff. So these always, they don't replace each other. Now here's the one that no textbook is talking about yet. And this is the 800-pound gorilla of the 21st century. The cryptocurrencies. There are a number of them. Bitcoin, Ripple, Ethereum. These have extreme liquidity and absolutely zero intrinsic value. They are the pure form of money. Every semester, my own finance club, I bring in a cryptocurrency expert and give the lowdown. It is the future. It is not going to replace the other ones. And right now, it is in a really rough situation, just like a lot of new technologies. The one thing you'll see is governments just pee themselves trying to stop. The best example I've heard is the one when cars were first introduced to the roads in Britain, which before the United States, laws were quickly passed. A car must have a flagman a quarter mile in front of it to warn people it's coming, and it must have a navigator as well as a driver. And it just So the governments of the world right now are striving to try to control this because they don't understand it. Truth be told, some of the people who are using it don't understand it, but it is the future. I'm going to give you a word here. This is behind cryptocurrencies, blockchain. If you want to know what the future is, it's blockchain. It's pervading finance, production, record keeping. The blockchain is awesome, and it is very hard to get your mind around. As a matter of fact, even a cryptocurrency itself is really hard to get your mind around what it is. It's not just, I buy and sell with it. Eventually, we'll get to that point. But right now, it's still primitive enough that the people who are getting into it have to understand it on a deep level. That's where you can have entrepreneurial opportunities within companies. When they finally grasp that cryptocurrencies are here to stay, they'll need people who know what they are. If you understand this whole process, you can be in front of the ball. Right now, countries hate the currency, and they're doing everything they can to get it. Some of the biggest investment houses in the world are quietly gathering their mass of cryptocurrencies. China uses its slave labor, millions of prisoners, to play video games until they pass out from exhaustion to earn bitcoins, cryptos, for the People's Bank of China. North Korea, its hackers are all over the world trying to break in to the purses, the coin purses, to get money out of the cryptocurrency out of them. Governments like our own government pompously saying we're busting these evil people on the dark web who have these cryptocurrencies. No, they're trying to steal it from them so they can have some of it themselves because they're too stupid to understand how to get it right way. So they bust up all of these things, like Silk Road and all that, claiming we've got to stop the drug dealers, we've got to stop the assassins, we've got to stop the illegal pornographers. Nah, they just want to get their coins and gather them and amass them. They don't know what to do with them, really, but some countries are banning the cryptocurrencies, which is, of course, like, we're going to ban air. Anyway, that's your future, folks. Cryptos, and they will become dominant. They're still highly unstable. Don't think you're a genius because you got some Bitcoin and they skyrocketed in price, because as fast as they go up, they'll go down and all that kind of stuff. So play carefully in the field and don't put all your eggs in one basket. Not yet. Look, if you're interested in this, come to my office. We'll just talk. And the best way for you to understand is just keep hearing me talk and talk about it. And it begins to slowly sink in. I understand. I get it. Ethereum protocol for the blockchain is powerful. It's being embraced. It looks like it is going to be, or some variation on it, will be the standard, is the Ethereum. So look up Ethereum. Anyway, I did want to cover that with you. Like I said, a lot of our classes here in business are preparing you for great jobs in the 20th century. And what I'm trying to do is give you a little bit of a window into what the 21st century is going to look like. It ain't your grandma's job prospects for people who want great paying jobs. Okay, now I'm going to go on to ethics now. Now here is where it gets uncomfortable. And I'm going to challenge you. And I'm going to tell you real stories. I am told, as I mentioned in the last lecture, the state of Illinois wants us to teach you ethics. But what they think I should teach you is, here are the laws, ethics laws, thou shalt obey them or thou shalt get paddle, paddle, paddled. And that's not, ethics is not law. Law is a pale attempt to impose a parochial set of ethical standards, but it is not ethics. And I use the word ethics because it is inappropriate in the modern world to use the real world word, morality. Well, that might have something to do with religion. Well, actually, it doesn't, but if I say moral action, then people say, oh, you're trying to preach us religion, which I'm not. If I were, I'd start my own religion, my own church, and make more money. I didn't say that. Okay, I have to edit this broadcast. Okay. I'm going to offer a couple of challenges to you. Before I get into the meat of it, I'm going to offer two ethical dilemmas. Very different. The first one is really uncomfortable. I'm going to tell you a story, ma'am. Okay? Story, I'm a veteran. A veteran of Vietnam had a story to tell. One day he was in country, and he had gotten separated from his platoon just slightly. He was forward. He was on point. And right there at the edge of a ville, there was a boy, maybe 10 years old. Now, this soldier had his rifle. Hand right there where the trigger was. He could flip it and shoot. The boy was standing there, and the boy was holding an RPG, a rocket-propelled grenade launcher, almost as big as the kid was, pointing it at him. What would you have done? Now, the boy was shaking. The soldier was shaking. What would you have done if you had been that soldier? Come on. Got nothing? Well, if you got nothing, then you have made a choice of action. That's actually, there is no such thing as no choice. I choose not to choose. Well, you chose. Okay? We're going to get you stronger on that. Trust me on this. What would you have done?
I probably would have shot him.
What would you have done? You. Shoot the mofo. No. Well, that soldier went on after his service to get a law degree and serve in the Congress of the United States as a great representative. The people of the other party were hatefully making fun of him, but he, of course, had two of his legs. Both of his legs were gone, and one of his arms was gone. The kid fired. Okay? First rule of war, never assume intentions, only capabilities. Never assume intentions, only capabilities. Do not say, well, he says, what can he do? In business, this is crucial. And in the remainder of this lecture, it will be a crucial underlying assumption of how we conduct ourselves in the business world, while understanding the ethical underpinnings of our decision making using that rule. Now I'm going to take you to another story, true story. Now this one has gotten me in hot water because I have been accused. There are right-wing websites that attack this man. Vile websites because they hate his religion. I have no use for those people, and if they listen to this podcast, as always, you can kiss my ass. Go away, you right-wing neo-Nazis. We killed you once, chased you back to hell, and here you are again. But, unfortunately, this story kind of comports with what they say about this guy, except they're all too stupid to really understand what happened. Okay, now, this goes back. This is a story of a man and his team who ran a fund, kind of like a currency fund. Now, there were these two countries. Country A and Country B and a bunch of countries around it all had an agreement that they would keep their currencies trading within a range a band of trade so that none of the countries ever got an advantage in exports, and no country ever came to much of a disadvantage in exports. That's why you set up these agreements with countries, so that you're really working together so that everyone benefits from trade and one currency does not go so far south that it kind of goes outside of the band and then the trade balance gets all whacked out of shape. Now, I don't need you to really understand that too much, except to make sure that you know that country A is somewhat unusual. It's a very dignified country that believes in agreements. It believes in the honor of contracts and all that kind of stuff. And so even if things are getting a little bit dodgy with its trading partners, we stick to our agreement. That's our way of doing things. Okay, well, not really intending to hurt any of its trading partners, country B had the opportunity to absorb the other part of its country that had been under communist rule for decades. When the Berlin Wall fell, Germany, West Germany, had the opportunity to just bring back East Germany into its nation. The problem was that East Germany was a crippled, miserably mess economically, socially, institutionally, the infrastructure was disastrously awful. And so West Germany was going to have to spend a lot of money, billions and billions, tens of billions of dollars, to rehabilitate East Germany so that it was all one modern Germany. The problem with doing that is that Germany borrowed a lot of money to do it. And when Germany borrowed money, it drove up German interest rates. In order to attract lenders, your interest rates go up. Well, what that has the effect of doing is making the Deutschmark extremely strong against countries that aren't doing that. Germany's interest rates were skyrocketing, and that meant that these countries, whose interest rates weren't, their currencies became very weak compared to Germany's. But they were all in this exchange rate mechanism, the ERM. And the problem was that if I would draw this as the currency band for this country's currency against the Deutschmark, it had always been bouncing around, and then it was bouncing right on the bottom of the exchange rate mechanism. It wanted to go down even way below that. But the agreement, the British, as they were, it's an agreement. So in order to keep their currency from collapsing, they just kept selling their gold. They kept selling assets to strengthen their currency. They would buy their own currency with their gold reserves. They would do anything they could to keep this bouncing from getting too violent, because the currency just wanted to collapse. And their economy was in the toilet. There was a recession. It wasn't horrible, but it was a recession. And so what the British wanted to do was lower their interest rates to help the economy, but they couldn't do that because that would make the problem even worse with the exchange rate band. So they held to the agreement, even though their currency was trying to go worse and worse and worse downward. It was an untenable situation. Sooner or later, they'd have to say, we're out of the exchange rate mechanism and let their currency collapse. But they could have controlled the fall when they finally decided to. Enter a man and his team. They saw this, and they knew that it would be a catastrophic drop in the currency. When the longer the exchequer of the currency held to the band at the bottom, the worse the collapse was going to be when it finally happened. So this gentleman and his team borrowed hundreds of millions of dollars of British pound sterling and used them to buy Deutschmarks. And then they waited. And finally, Britain said, okay, we're out. We've got to stop this. We've got to let the currency drop. Not really knowing that this man and his team, they had, what they would do is, as soon as that currency went cha-boom like that, they would sell their Deutschmarks back, and they would have so much money that they could pay back these loans that they had gotten in pounds sterling and pocket $2 billion in that currency of that time. That would be about $5 billion now. The effect of what they did was to destroy the Bank of England. The economy, which was teetering on a recession, went into a massive, enormous recession. Millions of people lost their jobs. Families fell apart. People committed suicide. There was even talk of the return of the king. And by the return of the king, I'm talking about King Cholera. George Soros gave the order to make the trade. Four words. He told his little lackey, go for the jugular. And Soros made $2 billion. Now imagine that. $2 billion just for you. Now all of these other traders had watched Soros getting his position and they followed him in. So the whole effect was staggering. But he was the leader. Now you could have the chance. $2 billion. You will never ever want for anything again. You will become a philanthropist and you will have people love you and sing your praises. School children will sing to you when you go to visit the school that you gave them the money to build. A whole political party will fall on its knees and drool on you. You will not be sick like other people because you have enough money to buy things that other people don't even know exist. You can have anything you want and anyone you want, Sparky. Or you could go to the Bank of England and say, here's what we could do, and we're not going to do it. Let's work together here. Let's fix this problem, and let's see if we can have a soft landing. Or you can say, go for the jugular. Your choice. What are you going to do? By the way, I have no problem with whatever you say. What would you do? No, again, you're not making a choice, so you are making a choice. Come on.
Help other people out.
What would you do, sir?
Jugular.
Ma'am?
Fix the bank.
You. What would you do?
Take the money.
Take the money, say, go for the jugular. What would you do? The money? What would you do, sir?
Fix the bank.
You know what? In your lives, you'll have choices to make like this. You see, either way you play it, are you going to serve yourself or are you going to serve a larger purpose? And this is where we come to the ethical part of this ethics. Because ethics doesn't tell you thou shalt or thou shalt not, because you have to understand what kind of ethics you want to follow. Let me give you the idea here. And here is where I'm going to have to flex some of the muscle I have in other disciplines, just so I can get a framework on this. The problem is that you're told, do the ethical things, and you're not given an ethical framework. There is not an ethic that is right or wrong. You have to make a choice for yourself. And part of that's embedded deep in you. But let me start with an interesting story that during the time that in ancient Greece, when Alexander the Great and several other leaders were conquering the known world, they had a policy that once they had subdued a country, they were going to want to understand the country. They weren't just going to force the country to abide by them. They were so influential that a lot of people would actually want to be like Greeks once they were under the occupation of the Greeks. It's an odd thing about that. But anyway, now Alexander the Great and the others, when they would conquer these countries, they would send back the country's laws and treaties to their translators, the great philosophers in ancient Greece, who would read them and then translate them into ancient Greek so that they could understand the peoples that they were now ruling. And something strange happened. And some of the philosophers that you might know, Aristotle, Plato, Aristotle especially, when he did these translations, he kept seeing something that was driving him mad. He thought it was really interesting, because no matter where these conquests were in the known world, into the north, the east, the west, down into parts of northern Africa, into the South Asia, they saw in all of these laws so many different odd things, you know, this, that, and the other thing, invoking different gods and all that, but they always found a core of laws that were the same everywhere. Now, they knew that these people hadn't known each other. These people can't possibly have communicated. It's almost like they're coming up with the same set. Now, this is a narrow set. For example, the safety of non-combatants in war, the proper disposition for fairness in trials, the appropriate way to treat soldiers who are captured. Now, they didn't abide by these all the time, but at least these were always in these laws. It came to be known in, this was a Latin term for it, jus gentia. Jus law of nations, gentia, the feminine diminutive. That's what I wanted to say. Okay. A set of common laws that were everywhere. Use, justice. Well, the Romans, who followed the Greeks and brought the Greek scholars to teach them everything, the Romans got a hold of this idea, and they were quite fascinated by this possibility that there was something in all humanity that said the same thing. It came to be understood as jus naturalis, the natural law. And later philosophers would talk about natural law, and you even have these morons today who talk about natural law party. They don't really understand the point. The point is to find this core that seems to echo throughout the human experience, no matter where they are, it is there. A set of principles by which action is taken, or at least by which we idealize action. Jus naturalis. So this isn't just an invention of modern or some artificial thing. Apparently, there really is something underneath all of us, at least in our civic action. Okay, now, take that off the board here, and I'm going to give you the first attempt or approach. Taking it out of religious, you have the religious law kind of thing, but the first philosopher who really addressed the how do we act ethically? What does it mean to act ethically? His name was Immanuel Kant. Now, Kant, he laid out what came to be known as the categorical imperative. I caution that this sounds like the golden rule, but it's not. The categorical imperative works like this. You would take your actions will always be what you would expect of others in all of their actions. your actions would always be what you would expect of all others in action. Now that sounds like do unto others as you would have them do unto you, but no, it's not. This is a deeper principle. Always. If I don't want other people to do this, I will not do it. It doesn't matter whether what is being done is to someone else. If I don't want them to do that to someone else, I will not do that to someone else. That is the categorical imperative, and it is actually quite powerful, but it is not situational. There is no situation. You will do this, regardless of the situation, if this is what you would expect other people to do. Now, it applies to your own personal life, too. This has to do, to take on a rather uncomfortable subject, with the inappropriate activities of certain men in high office. I won't mention any names. if you don't want another man to do what you are thinking of doing, then don't you do it. Okay? If you don't want every other guy to grab... I stopped. If you don't want them to do it, maybe to your daughter, then why the hell would you even think of doing it yourself to someone else's daughter? Really? See how powerful the categorical imperative is, but it's a fist. It doesn't give you latitude for action based upon a set, well, I'm drunk, it's okay. No, always. Categorical imperative. Now, this is an absolutist approach to ethics. Later came in the 1700s and the 1800s what was known as situational ethics. Now, there were two different kind of broad approaches to it. John Stuart Mill laid out one of them. But it essentially says, one side says, for a given situation, you will always act in this way. The other side said, well, how can you say for a situation when things can be so fluid that you must actively make a decision in each one? But at the core, one approach to situational ethics is the greatest good for the greatest number. That's one approach, and there are other approaches, but that one is one approach. This is an ethical guideline. When I act in such a way that I am doing the best for the most people. Even if that might mean this. Let me take you on. You are a research analyst at a major drug company. You have developed a drug. It has made it through the trials. And one of your assistants comes in and says, we went through the clinical trials and we did not see this. We are curing what was otherwise a fatal disease in 95% of the children who are taking this drug. But in 5% of them, it's killing them within days. They could have lived months. We just thought it was like just those kids dying. No. Their life expectancies, there's a clear cluster of 5% of the kids dying way before they were expected to with this disease. But 95% of the kids are free of the disease for the rest of their lives. You're going to go to the press conference tomorrow and announce the availability of the drug. What do you do? Do you see how the situation is? Greatest good for the greatest number? Do you buy it? Are you going to say, we have got a drug that is awesome? Or are you going to go there and say, we're not releasing this. It kills kids. What do you do? Talk to me. You're not going to have time to sit around and paw in your face. You're going to have to make decisions very quickly in the business world. Say it. You're going to say, release the drug. Ma'am. What if it's your child who was one of the 5%? Ouch. Damn. It's one of those things, well, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play? Historical reference, never mind. Okay, you see the problem with this approach? Because there are human lives. And then there's the other approach. No, sort of the one that I remember, I don't know if they still believe in this, but I think they do in the Army. No man is left behind. No one. He might be over there and there might be fire coming down all over the place. We're going to go and bring him out. The greatest good for the greatest number, we say, you're on your own, asshole. But we don't do it that way in the service. And a lot of people are quite grateful that we don't. But we also lose a lot more soldiers doing it this way, too. Because if there's a sniper up there, he's going to wound that guy. And that guy's going to be screaming for us to help him. And every one of us who goes out there is going to get picked off. Or we can just walk away and let that sniper just keep using him for a bullet sponge. Either way, it hurts like hell. And that's the thing about ethics. It hurts like hell when you actually have to confront it. Now I'm going to take you to the agency dilemma. And this is where I put teeth into this. You're going to face ethical choices in your professional life. And you're going to have to decide what you're going to do. Because if you don't decide, then you have decided anyway. So you might as well pretend that you have free will. But here's the part of this where I bring up the agency dilemma. The agency dilemma is actually quite simple. I should make a mention here. The word person in law means, it could be an individual, but it really means anything that is an identifiable legal entity. So a person could be an individual, a person could be a partnership, a person could be a corporation. Okay? So make sure you understand, when I say person, I don't mean a meat sack. I mean an integrated, legally identifiable entity. When one person called the agent, is charged with maximizing some welfare of another person called the principal. That's PAL. The agent has the incentive to maximize his or her own welfare instead. This is a hardcore principle, the agency dilemma. In other words, if your job is to maximize my welfare, whether or not you act on this incentive, you have the incentive to do what's best for yourself instead. I give you $20 to go to Steak and Shake and get me two Royal Burgers. You know those ones, the cheeseburger with the egg on top I know, right? I mean, cholesterol level, you know, like that. You're my agent. You're maximizing my welfare on something. You have an incentive to say, oh, I'm going to go down here and buy my own stuff at Whataburger. No, they closed. You can't do that. Okay, you see, you have incentive. And you will be managers. And if you pretend that the agency dilemma doesn't exist, you will be eaten alive. You do it both ways. You are driving down one of these country roads out here, sir. Okay? It is a clear day, just beautiful straight road, no traffic, just a wonderful day. And you look at your speedometer and you see this sign says 55 miles per hour. Well, I found out you guys out here, you see that as challenge accepted. So you put your foot on that pedal, and you hear this voice in the back seat say, warp 6. Stars start streaming by the car and all that kind of stuff. Okay. Okay, but then, way up the road, you notice in one of the spurs into a field, there's a car stopped. There's a car parked there. And as you get closer and closer, you begin to realize, oh my God, that's a sheriff's deputy car. What are you going to do? You got it, Ace. Have you ever noticed, you're driving along, everyone's flying, driving, and all of a sudden all the brake lights come on. Well, you know what they saw? They saw a cop, and they found Jesus. Monitoring. Okay, but as you get closer, you suddenly realize, oh God, he's standing out. He's probably got one of those radar guns. No, he's standing there. He's looking at his flat tire. So you drive by. Hi, officer. How you doing? What are you going to do? He can't do anything to you. What are you going to do?
Probably going to stay the same speed.
And go oh, you are? Really? No, you're not. I mean, come on. You could drive faster. You could give him the finger. You could say, bite me. Is that your mama's car? You see, there are two components to the enforcement of the contract, monitoring and enforcement. If you can watch but you don't enforce, you got no deal. If you can enforce but you're not watching, you got no deal. Notice here that it is the principal's job to stop the agency dilemma. It is not the agent's job. The agent will be the agent. You are going to, I have to assume, your capabilities, not your intentions. I have to assume that if you're going to maximize my welfare, you're going to do what's best for you. Whether or not you are, you might be a wonderful kid. You might read to the elderly. You might pick up litter in the park. But I have to assume otherwise, just like that soldier did. The consequences on the downside are far worse than the upside of trusting your fellow human. That doesn't mean that, well, yeah, it does mean you got to be a cynical bastard like I am, but okay. So monitoring and enforcement are both critical, and they are the responsibility of the principal. Because the principal is the one. If you are my agent and you do something stupid, I, as the principal, have the vicarious liability. I am what we call respondeat superior. A story about this from West Virginia, and that starts you off knowing there's going to be something bad happen. Okay, there was a bar that got very popular because there was a bartender who was incredible with knives. He could pitch a knife and just nail a card on the wall, anything like that. Well, one night, one of the old-time, real hardcore bikers walked right in front of that knife, and it went in his eye. He drove himself to the hospital's emergency room. As the story goes, the receptionist wasn't even looking at him. She said, take a number, we'll take it. The guy said, lady, look at me, ask me if this hurts. So she looked up and then she went to a happy place because there was a knife sticking out of his eyeball, eye socket. The guy sued the bar owner. And the bar owner said, oh, I didn't give this guy permission to do that. So it's not my liability. Oh, yes, it is. You are the respondeat superior. He was the agent. You are the principal. You carry the liability. Okay? So that's what gives you the incentive as the principal not to assume intentions, only capabilities. Well, he didn't do what he was supposed to. Doesn't matter. Were you monitoring? Had you put down rules? Did you have clear sanctions for inappropriate action? No, no, no. Guess what? You buy that guy a new Harley. And one with an extra little wind of view screen because he's got only one eye now. I'm teaching you about management, about the broad world of business here. It applies deeply in finance because finance is corrupt as hell at the top layers. Here's another ethical dilemma. A woman who was in charge of overseeing credit card accounts at one of the largest banks in the world realized that the credit card customers were being screwed on their on what they were being told they had to pay. She reported it to the inspector general of the company, of the bank. She did everything up the line. They ignored her. So she blew the whistle. She spent the next 6 years of her life in hiding, one motel to another, while anonymous death threats came at her, while the lawyers for this giant bank sued her back and forth. Oh, but there's whistleblower laws. Yeah, watch those actually happen in practice. Her life was wrecked. Her children, she lost her children, if I understand, because she couldn't keep them in a safe place. Now, if you were in her situation and you saw that all these millions of customers were being screwed, would you blow the whistle knowing what happens to whistleblowers like her? Would you? Talk to me. You would. Somehow I thought that you'd say that. What would you do? Your life's going to be destroyed if you blow the whistle. No. Hell, screw that. How about you, sir?
No.
You? You know, a couple of you are looking like, sure, I'll do that. Yeah, like, well, you're going to face those kinds of ethical dilemmas. You're going to see things that you don't want to see, possibly, and then you're going to have to decide, what is my ethical action? Okay, now, agents extract their costs. Now, let me get to this. Okay, agent and principal. Okay, I'll give you one to start off with. The officers and directors at the top level of a corporation are the agents of the shareholders. Their job is to maximize the wealth of the shareholders. Now, if you've ever heard that word stakeholder, that is baloney. Their job is to maximize the wealth of the shareholders. Okay, so the officers and directors are the agents and the principals are the shareholders as a body. Not the individual shareholders, the person of the shareholders as a body. Now going on to a few others, let's try this one. Ma'am, in a parent-child relationship, who is the agent and who is the principal? Well, which one is responsible for maximizing the welfare of the other? The parent. Oh, the parent is the agent of the child. Isn't that interesting? See, I'm trying to turn and get your thinking a little bit straighter here. Let's try this one. Sir, a marriage. Man and woman, husband and wife, who's the agent and who's the principal? Careful, boy. Oh, I know what you want to say. You know you want to keep your teeth. Ma'am, who's the agent, who's the principal? Okay. The marriage is the principal. It's a person. It is nothing but a piece of paper, but it is a person under the law. It is an identifiable legal entity. And both the husband and the wife are the agents. Their job is to maximize the welfare of the marriage. Isn't that interesting? I'm trying to get you to see contract, see responsibility in a new way. Now, you're a husband in a marriage. Your wife is out of town. You get a call from your old, some old friends of yours in a sorority, and they say, hey, we need a new judge for our twerkathon tonight. Are you in?
No.
What are you going to say?
Yeah.
Yeah. But you're. You didn't even pause. You notice, though, the point there is that his job is to maximize the welfare of the marriage. Is that going to maximize the welfare of the marriage? No. Fail. You see, in action, this becomes, let's try this one. A soldier is an agent. What's the principle? The Constitution of the United States, which I swear to protect and defend against all enemies, both foreign and domestic. It's just a piece of paper. But it is a principle, and I am charged as a soldier. I take an oath to protect it. Now, agents extract costs in... Oh, wait, think about this. And one more. Okay, parent and child. Let's go back to that. You see, my job is to maximize the welfare of my children. What that would mean, I come home from work, and I drag in, and there are the kids bouncing around, jumping on things, squeaking and screaming and squealing, and all of this, and you know, just acting up, and they're starving and they're fussy. And so what I'm supposed to do is I'm supposed to run up to the, oh, come here, let me give you a huggy. I'll make you a nutritious meal from scratch. And then I'll give you a bathy, and then I'll read you bookies for bed, you know, all this kind of stuff. Oh, I love you so much. And, you know, come down off the couch where you're bouncing. I could hurt yourself, sweetheart. You know what happens? I stagger in. I'm talking as a former parent. You just drop down and you're, oh, God. You know, get off that couch. Stop bouncing. Here, take my belt. Beat yourself. You're bad. Get some Nuke and Puke out of the freezer and make yourself some damn food. And bring Daddy a beer. Agent. Incentive to maximize own welfare instead of that of the principal. It's pervasive. And there has to be monitoring and enforcement of the contract. Now, here are the ways that agents extract costs. We break them down into five broad categories. Now, some break them down into more. Some break them down into fewer. But here's five. The agency costs. When we talk about a problem in finance, we want a liquidated or liquidatable value. In other words, a dollar value, a way that we can measure this cost. Now, understand that monitoring and enforcement is expensive. So there's a limit to how you control agency costs. If it costs more to keep your employees from pinching a few staples than it does to monitor and enforce, well, you're going to let things slide. So these costs are relative. The first one is perquisites. Now, perquisites, otherwise sometimes known as perks, are benefits extracted by position of an agent. Benefits extracted by position of an agent. That would be, for example, the CEO of a corporation who has a desk in his office the size of a small landing strip. That would be these top executives who fly first class. I was at a dinner a few years back, and they were talking. They asked me what my salary is, and they were flabbergasted at how low it is. They said, "Why did you come to work for us? We need a comptroller." I said, "You don't need me. You know, you want to take that private jet of yours? Greyhound goes to most cities. Want to stay in a 5-star hotel? Well, no, Motel 6. And I can even tell you the ones that have that quarter machine in the room. And one person right. You want to eat at these fancy restaurants? Well, you got to eat at the best places to show how strong we are as a company. No, McDonald's serves. And they thought I was joking. I said, I'm not joking. I don't care what you think your precious asses want. Every dollar you spend on yourselves in excess of what you must is a dollar that your shareholders aren't getting. That is an extraction of a perquisite agency cost, period. They changed this conversation on me. The next one is shirking. avoiding your duties as an agent. This is the person who goes around the office chatting with everyone instead of sitting at his desk doing his work. I did a consulting job some quite a few years back, and there was this one manager. I figured it out very quickly. I asked the others, what's this about? And they said, yeah, every morning he would show up exactly at 8 o'clock. Exactly when he was supposed to. And then he would go, and as he walked by the receptionist's desk, he would grab the Wall Street Journal, and he would go into the toilet, and he would be there for 40 minutes exactly. That man was so regular, I wanted to know what he was eating as far as fiber goes. Every morning he did this. That's shirking. It's that manager, my desk is clear every night. Yeah, because you take all your work and you put it on your subordinates' desks. Yeah, everyone here knows it. What you're doing. You're shirking your own responsibilities. Very common. Huge, as a matter of fact. Have you ever been in one of those places where there's a cashier who's moving in slow motion? Just, will you please hurry up and get my... Anyway, shirking. Now here is one. Direct theft. Just stealing. Theft by employees is just an agency dilemma. How much is it going to cost to put monitors everywhere and to enforce policies and to hire the people to watch the monitors? Compare that to the cost of how much the employees are stealing. It's staggering how much is taken. What's funny, though, is that all of these executives and these conservative business analysts and all that talk about is such a massive problem, employee theft. Well, why have you never, ever talked about perquisites at the top of the food chain? Oh, that's because they pay your little side payments to bitch about the employees. But yes, direct theft is common. It is huge. And it is an agency cost. Here's one. 4, lying. Ma'am, have you ever lied? Yeah. Say no, for heaven's sake. Have you ever lied?
No.
Okay, good. You see, lying is what we all do to one extent or another, depending upon the situation. Especially if you have the choice of telling the truth and being beaten crapless, or lying and maybe getting out of it, you're going to lie. Okay? We learn that from an early age. We avoid pain and punishment. Okay, I went to a Catholic school for a few years, which was really weird. But I mean, when that nun would ask me if I was the one who drew that picture of her as a fat cow on the board, no, sister, I didn't do that. Do you know who did? I'd find who I didn't like in the class and say, he did it. Okay, that worked at first until she started using that stick on my head. Okay, lying. It's done very commonly in the business world. Have you gotten that project done yet? Well, I'm waiting for this email message. Or one of just last week, a top manager at one of the companies, big companies here in town, she said, I had given him this project like 2 months ago, and we've got, and on Monday we're going to the conference where we show this PowerPoint presentation I told him to do. I asked him on Thursday, have you got it done? He said yes. On Friday, I saw him at his desk frantically working on the first frame for that PowerPoint. You will find lying as a common thing. Now, it's probably, there are two approaches. You can simply jump right over someone and say, you lie. Or you can make it clear that you know there's a lie, but not push it to the point where you've ruined the possibility that the relationship can be repaired. And in that second situation, though, you still have to make it clear, don't do this again, you idiot. Now, the last one in this line is incompetence. Have you ever worked with someone who was so stupid, the person shouldn't even be alive? I mean, we're talking so stupid, the IQ is down there, handball on the curb. Box of Rocks is really saying something not very nice about rocks. stupid ass. Here's the problem, though. This was a management principle that people who didn't understand it thought was a joke back in the 80s. Dr. Peter, a management guru, laid out the Peter principle. Everyone rises to his or her own level of incompetence. You do good at a job, well, we're going to promote you. Oh, you do good in that job, we'll keep promoting you until you don't do a good job, and then you'll stay there. You go into any corporation, everyone in that corporation is either on the road to or has achieved his or her level of incompetence. Period. You will just keep advancing until you can't do the job anymore. And then you will stay there. Some people start very early with their first job. They can't do it. They stay right there. And then others go up. You see football coaches. They are idiots. They are terrible. But they kept winning when they were at the high school, then at the college level. And so they put them in at the major leagues, and that boy just can't do it. You see baseball players like this too. They get in the, they were great in the minors. You get them onto the field. You see performers. They're great in community theater or singing for mom and dad. You put them up there on a stage with several thousand people, and they are horrible. I'll finish this next week. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.